Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Dr. Mohan Soonta, the president and CEO of the University of Maryland Medical System. We'll talk about the UMMS response to the COVID pandemic and implications for public health in Maryland moving forward. Plus, we'll take up the question, should there be such a thing as a hate crime? The trial in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery is underway in Georgia. If a crime is proven, then a person's guilt presumably will be covered by existing statutes. Should the motive for that crime, even if it is despicable and grounded in racial or any other kind of bias, affect how that crime is punished? We'll talk about it tomorrow on Midday. Now it's Midday on transportation. Dr. Lawrence Brown of Morgan State University coined the phrase the black butterfly and the white L to describe the boundaries between black and white neighborhoods in Baltimore and the socioeconomic disparities between them. A new report on transit equity shows environmental and public health impacts within those boundaries as well. In short, a poorly designed and poorly functioning mass transit system creates problems that include but also transcend people having trouble getting to and from work and school. So let's examine what those problems are and how best to address them. My next guests are the co-authors of the study that does examine transit equity and its correlation to public health in Baltimore. Dr. Megan Weil Latshaw is an associate scientist in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Latshaw, welcome.
Thanks. I'm so honored to be here, Tom.
And Samuel Jordan is the co-founder and president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. Sam, welcome back to you as well, sir.
Thanks, Tom, and good afternoon, Megan.
Glad to have both of you with us. And listeners, if you would like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear your experience taking public transit in Baltimore. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. To email us, it's midday@wypr.org. To send us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. So Dr. Latshaw, if I may, let me start with you. What did you hope to study? What was your aspiration with this report? What did you take a look at? And how did you organize your research?
So the inspiration for the report came from Mr. Jordan. He said to me one day, you know, we really need to do some maps. We need to show how transit and social vulnerability and pollution and health, how they all sort of overlay and what the patterns are in Baltimore City so that we can bring data to the decision-making table so we can drive investments to where they're needed the most. And so that was the impetus behind this. And, you know, that pretty much gave us pretty clear expectations of what we needed to do. So we created four maps, one for each of those areas. And then we overlaid them and identified which neighborhoods really sort of popped out as needing more investments in transit as a way to improve not only, you know, people's ability to get to work or to get to school or to get healthy food or healthcare, but also as a way to maybe reduce greenhouse gas emissions and reduce pollution and improve health. So transit offers a lot of ways to benefit public health.
And Sam Jordan, the report that you co-authored with Dr. Latshaw takes a look at various areas, including, you know, transit itself, the access, the accessibility, the efficacy of it, an index that you call social vulnerability, air pollution, and health. What did you mean by the rubric of social vulnerability?
We were looking at housing patterns. We were looking at income. We were also looking at, access to transit with the transit equity oppression map, of course. But social vulnerability meant what factors, in addition to income, are shaping the quality of life for these families.
And Dr. Latshaw, one of the conclusions in this report is that different parts of the city, different census tracts, do have different environmental challenges. This is something that folks on the political right often take up as silliness. They dismiss the possibility that one neighborhood, one area of town might have worse pollution than another area of town. But your research knocks that contention down quite solidly, doesn't it? There is a difference in terms of the exposure that people have to pollutants in the air depending on where they live.
Absolutely. And our research, you know, it could be even better. We're seeing now people talking about the hyper-local level when it comes to air pollution and microclimates. And so, unfortunately, the way that the system has been set up, we don't have a lot of air pollution measurements for Baltimore City. We only have three monitors in the city. And so we really only know at a hyper-local level what's going on around those three monitors. And the rest of it, we had to model. And so we hope that, you know, maybe one of the policies that can be changed as a result of this work and other work is we need to start collecting air pollution data at a much smaller scale, because it varies from block to block. Surprisingly, people are surprised by that, but more and more evidence is showing that that is the case.
And Sam Jordan, far and away, it's mostly people of color taking the bus, taking the light rail, taking the subway, using public transit. High percentage of people of color using the public transportation system. And they are also, this demographic is more likely to live in neighborhoods that are affected by air pollution, whether they're driving a car or not. So just where they're living really does matter. What did you find in that regard? I mean, and because this is digging deeper. You've been on the show many times, and we've talked about the issues of equity. The location of where folks are living and the environmental impacts have really been correlated in this report. What did you find?
Well, that is precise of what we found, that the housing patterns in Baltimore have actually been one of the most dominant influences on public policy in Baltimore. In fact, all other public policy that pertains to, again, this quality of life. Redlining itself, for example, has not only determined where schools are. There used to be black versus white schools, the transportation patterns. In fact, the bus network that we have today is a legacy of transportation patterns developed during this period of redlining, for example. So what we have found is that, one, as Dr. Brown's report shows in his studies, the spatialization of race in public policy has, in fact, resulted in areas of the city that were at one time practically reserved to blacks only and to whites only. Well, those patterns have continued to impact public policy, whether it's in food security, education, schools, employment. And what we have found, although we didn't set out to confirm or affirm the black butterfly, white L pattern, the data showed that pattern was indeed operable, still determining public policy. And we wanted to demonstrate that Baltimore actually has now, with an instrument like our project and other studies, perhaps, we'll collect them, assemble them, but Baltimore has the tools to address these issues in these communities that mark the convergence of public transportation, public health, and emissions from harmful pollutants.
Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear from listeners about your experience with the public transportation system and public transit in Baltimore. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And Dr. Latshaw, you mentioned in the report that if the public transportation system were improved, that there would be fairly certain improvements in public health for some of the reasons that we've already talked about. We have a email from a listener in Reisterstown, Mark, who echoes an interesting idea that I've heard adduced by Seema Iyer, who's over at the University of Baltimore and studies the city. But Mark says there's a good chance that ride sharing using autonomous vehicles may someday largely replace public transportation. This has the advantage of reducing the need for private vehicles and their infrastructure, as well as being door to door rather than station to station as a subway system would be. So my question is, how might this be made equitable so that less privileged people would have equal access? So Dr. Latchaw, let's divide that in two sections here. Do you think that a ride sharing model could someday replace public transportation? This is something that Seema Iyer, I think, has talked about. She's certainly talked about combining all of the different transit systems and improving it on that level. But what do you think about ride sharing as a future of public transportation?
It's certainly a fascinating idea, and it's probably going to come to pass. Two things that come to mind. One is the best way to move people around is to increase the number of people per vehicle. And so, you know, public transit does that very well, usually. Have, you know, dozens of people on a single vehicle. And so you're decreasing each individual person's greenhouse gas footprint and air pollution footprint when you do that. But as you noted, also, you know, public transit involves getting to a stop, right? A transit stop. And people generally prefer door to door. It's easier. But that also means that people won't be walking to transit stops or biking to transit stops. And so one of the benefits that comes with public transit is it tends to get people to get extra steps in every day as they walk to their, to the, you know, whether it's from their home to the transit stop or from their transit, the destination to the transit stop. So I think it's probably going to come and we should be prepared for it. But I do think it will maybe lessen some of the public health benefits we see with public transit.
And Sam Jordan, what Seema Iyer talks about, because let me ask you to comment. She's talking about eliminating all of the separate bus lines that we have operating in the city. And I know you want to have a metropolitan, a regional approach to transit. That's something we need to talk about. But she's also talking about free bus passes for everybody and basically have on-demand bus technology, not just individual cars. Your comments.
Sure, I'd like to comment because we're confusing a number of issues. First, we always, when we're addressing a problem, we have to answer this question. What problem are we really trying to solve? And the problem that we are trying to solve is not only greatly improve transit equity, but also, of course, the massive impact that light rail has on regional economy and its transit-oriented development. But with respect to mobility itself, first of all, Dr. Latchaw's reference is precise. Efficiency is in mass transit, not individual automobiles, autonomous or however they'll be steered. The issue is, what do we get? What's the bang for the buck? What's the greatest efficient weather? This is actually a replication of what we have in the autocentric culture. You know, the idea that everybody needs, in order to be free, their own personal and private vehicle. That's the, again, emphasizing the role of the individual and individualism when the collective well-being contains the answer. Mass public transportation is, even in the foreseeable future, the best response to the threat of climate change, the best response to the matter of environmental damage done by internal combustion engines. Now, are these autonomous vehicles all going to be electric vehicles? What about the cost? What about the clutter? What about the traffic? We haven't reduced traffic congestion if everyone has his or her own or their own personal autonomous vehicle. So the question always is, what issue are we trying to resolve? What problem are we attempting to solve? We should be attempting to solve, and the pandemic has shown us, with essential workers, we're going to have some divisions in the labor market and in the class structure in this country. There will still be for some time now, as you can imagine, wealthy as well as people of modest means. The car replicating the autocentric culture is another replication of the worst of a stratified society. We've learned that. We should take a lesson from what we have learned and understand that pursuing in the first place the collective well-being than pursuing the individual and individualism idea of what constitutes freedom. We have learned from that autocentric culture idea that sprawl creates nothing but inefficiency in the organization and design and vision for a city and a community. So we want to answer one question that's paramount. What constitutes for Baltimore the best response to improvement in transit equity, the best response to a massive increase and improvement in the economic growth of the region? Baltimore is losing now, as you know, 5.7% of its population in the last census. And we need to answer this question of the intersectionality of public transportation with all, in fact, many other areas of public policy: affordable housing, food security, education, employment, and the environment. Well, that doesn't happen when we address these issues with an autonomous vehicle.
And let's take one call about this issue as well. Then we're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation. Let's go to Matthew, who's on the line in Owings Mills. Welcome to the show with Samuel Jordan and Dr. Megan Latshaw.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment about ride-sharing services. There have been a number of studies in the past couple of days. There was actually an op-ed in the New York Times about this, showing that ride-sharing services increase congestion and increase pollution because you have more cars on the road, and at least 40% of the time, the rideshare vehicles are deadheading, meaning they're driving around waiting for a call. And I'll take the response off the air.
All right, that's a good point. Dr. Latshaw, do you want to respond to our caller, Matthew?
I thought he made a great point. It was exactly sort of what I was trying to get at, that the idea of keeping people in individual cars, in my mind, is not the ideal solution. That's not where we gain efficiency. And, you know, even one of the things that we haven't brought up in public health is the more vehicles there are on the road, the more likely there are to be injuries and fatalities. And so we're trying to, as Samuel said, increase the number of people per vehicle. And that, in my mind, is mass transit.
Absolutely. Dr. Megan Latshaw is an associate scientist in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And Sam, let me have you hold your thoughts as we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll start with it as soon as we come back. Samuel Jordan is the co-founder and president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. They are co-authors of a report called Transit Equity and Environmental Health in Baltimore City, and we'll have more on the report, and we'll hear more from you about your experiences with the transit system in Baltimore when we do return. 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @midday_WYPR. And before we go to our break, each week here on the program, it's our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 268 people have been victims of homicide in Baltimore City. Police have released the identities of two of the four people who were victims of homicide last week. They are Lamont Wade, age 47, and Jonas Ben Jr. He was 37 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday Morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Transportation today. We're talking about a report released last month by the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and the Baltimore Transit Equity Alliance called Transit Equity and Environmental Health in Baltimore City. My guests are the two co-authors of the report, Dr. Megan Latshaw, an associate scientist in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering at the Bloomberg School, and Samuel Jordan, the co-founder and president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. So what has your experience been with public transit in Baltimore? You can join us, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And Sam Jordan, you were nice enough to indulge me and hold your thought before the break. So let me have you continue our conversation.
And thank you, Tom. The caller confirmed the comment I had just made. I think it was excellent timing about this notion of AV, autonomous vehicles, versus mass transit, for example, versus what our mission is with the pursuit of the completion of the Red Line and the creation of a Baltimore Regional Transportation Authority, and what we saw in the project that we have just conducted, at least in the first stage, with Johns Hopkins. That is, the autonomous vehicle idea, as I mentioned, is a continued replication of what we had in the autocentric culture. Everybody has its own vehicle and can drive wherever they like, and that's a notion of freedom that was in fact endorsed by this autocentric culture. It didn't work for us. Efficiency, as Dr. Latshaw mentioned, is in having more persons, more riders per vehicle, not fewer. Congestion means also more riders than fewer riders per vehicle. It means mass transit. The collective well-being should be pursued, we think, and this is a lesson from the pandemic, over the individual's notion of freedom, for example. Not that people shouldn't be free. I don't want to have a constitutional question here. But mass transit also manages the matter of the cost of transit. With mass transit, we can have, for example, as Dr. Iyer, AmbiTech will join in a campaign for free vehicles, free transit among certain demographics, perhaps. But autonomous vehicles don't address that issue. What will be the cost of autonomous vehicles? Each person buys a vehicle, each home has a vehicle, or will they still be paying the price that Uber and Lyft cost relative to a household income? Uber and Lyft are a very expensive daily travel options relative to a household income. And we haven't solved that issue of home income. Are we going to have a guaranteed income? And that guaranteed income will include autonomous vehicles? Perhaps not. That's not what we're seeing. That's not the question being answered. The question is avoiding mass transit. That's being put by this flurry of interest in autonomous vehicles, when in fact, people are referring to their experience and the community's myth of public transit. We have so denigrated public transit and we have so many myths about public transit that in our system, in our culture in the United States, people avoid public transit. But that's not true of developed nations all over the world. That's not true of developed nations, in fact, that have continued to increase their improvements in public transportation during the pandemic. Taiwan, Hong Kong, Seoul, they have given us examples of what is the value of public transportation when we have a mass, in fact, a worldwide occurrence like this pandemic. So to draw my point, one, the caller confirmed my discussion about congestion, but we also addressed the intersectionality with healthcare, with the environment, with the pending threat of climate change. That's what completing the Red Line Light Rail Project can help accomplish, but that's also the gift of mass transit. That is not the gift of autonomous vehicle systems.
Sure. Klaus Philipson, who's a city planner and a great friend of this show, says while the boundaries between transit and autonomous vehicle ride sharing may blur, in the urban environment, there isn't enough space for everybody to ride in cars. So transit will continue to be relevant in cities. And Megan Latshaw, the correlation, the lineage between a good, effective, accessible public transit system and public health is, you know, one of the big points that you draw here in this report. But accessibility means access to jobs and grocery stores. You write about social supports, other quality of life measures. And it's also a public safety issue as well, isn't it? If people have to spend a lot of time waiting at the bus stop for at odd hours of the day and night, that can be a public, there's a public health and public safety implication for that in certain areas of the city as well.
You're absolutely right, Tom. And that was one of the things that we originally set out to measure. And unfortunately, we couldn't really find good data on what were the safety issues associated with transit. So we were able to find general crime statistics, but we weren't able to find a publicly available data set that showed, crimes or anything related to safety explicitly linked to transit. And so I think that's another takeaway that we hope that maybe policy can change. And this is maybe something that could be made publicly available. I'm sure MDOT MTA is tracking that. And so it would be nice if we could also have access to that.
Let's go to the phones to Beth, who's on the line from Phoenix. Beth, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you? My question comment goes back to what you folks were just talking about when it comes to equity and just having accountability. My brother has Down syndrome, and so he goes to a day program in the city. Since we live in the county, he has to be dropped off within a certain distance from a bus stop so he can be picked up by the MTA. However, those times are extremely inconsistent, and at the end of the day, when he's on his way back, he'll be like 4 to 5 hours late than the pickup time, so I'll just be sitting in a parking lot for hours on end, unsure where he is, and since he doesn't have those communication abilities, say you and I have, it's just very difficult to kind of play the middleman when I'm nowhere near him or the driver.
Thanks for that comment, Beth. And Sam Jordan, your efforts to establish a regional transit authority sounds like might be able to address this kind of thing and improving communication and improving the information that riders have about getting between the county and the city.
You know, we do address that issue because what we have found in the MDOT-MTA model is that there's very little attention given to solutions to that problem. What we want to do, I think, if the call is asking several questions at once, one is about mobility. The mobility system is dismal, to say the least. What we have are demographics among people who are disabled or ability challenged, who simply must make an appointment for mobility 24 hours in advance, and then wait after all the other appointments have been taken care of. In fact, their appointment might be at 10 o'clock, and they get home in the afternoon by 3 o'clock after only an hour's appointment, waiting through the several stops of the mobility service. So it's not well planned, and its results are not good. But with respect to the county and the city, we also have this deficiency. When MDOT-MTA launched the Baltimore Link, it did not conduct an origins and destinations study. In fact, it still hasn't done so and hasn't released one. So MDOT-MTA was never in possession of the kind of data needed to determine which, in fact, were the best routes, which, in fact, were the most efficient routes to take. Taking a survey, a definitive survey of just where people needed to go. The Towson Circulator, for example, the latest attempt in Baltimore County to help solve this problem. We spoke yesterday at the JFX Market while we were tabling for our Baltimore Regional Transportation Authority ballot access. Baltimore County residents who live still not within reach of the new Towson circulator. That problem hasn't been addressed. And under the management of transportation by Baltimore Regional Transportation Authority, we'll take a better look at that. We will, in fact, conduct an origins and destination study. We have in our project, our joint project with Johns Hopkins, the Transit Equity and Environmental Health in Baltimore City project, that's exactly what we're doing. We're looking at origins and destinations from one centroid in a centrist track to any of the other 200 census tracts in the city of Baltimore as a beginning stage of our report. And we can address those problems if we have an agency, if we have a regional voice and local voice in transportation policy, we can address those problems and solve them.
And Sam, very quickly, you and I ran into each other at the Waverly Farmers Market on Saturday. You mentioned you were under the expressway yesterday. The petition that you're asking people to sign would do what?
The petition will not build a red line. It is, in fact, what we call a ballot access petition. When we submit 10,000 valid petitions to the Board of Elections by August 1st of 2022, we gain access to the ballot in November of 2022. And on that ballot, we put a question to the city. Should we compel the city leadership to take the first steps in creating a Baltimore Regional Transportation Authority that will supplant the MDOT-MTA model that governs us now? After 6 years in Governor Hogan's administration, we have not seen any appreciable increase in transit equity. We have not seen at all any transit-oriented development, even remotely associated with the bus-centered and bus-anchored system that we have. The Baltimore Regional Transportation Authority concept that we are promoting is based on our review of regional transportation authorities around the country. It offers autonomy in policy making in transportation. It offers flexibility in funding. Directors of the authority can be elected in local elections, but it will also give regional jurisdictions and the city of Baltimore more direct input into transportation policy. So that Baltimore Regional Transportation Authority is our approach to the most viable path toward completing the Red Line Light Rail project. The Red Line project would be its highest priority, and the Red Line project, along with the state and federal funds and regional funds, can get started building out the kind of equitable, reliable public transportation system that we need for the Baltimore region.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Latshaw, let me give you the quick last word. We have a caller about this. We don't have time to get to the caller, but with the pandemic and people's reluctance to be in a bus or in a subway car or a light rail car, how does that weigh into future plans for public transportation?
Well, it's something that I know transit authorities across the world are thinking about and have thought about. And I think one of the best things that happened in this space was when we realized surfaces are not really, the way that this virus is being spread. And so the idea of simply opening windows on buses, increasing the air circulation on the buses can, I think, make people feel relatively safe, especially if they do the primary thing when it comes to the pandemic that keeps you safest, which is getting vaccinated.
Getting vaccinated and wearing a mask, for sure. Samuel Jordan is the co-founder and president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. Dr. Megan Latshaw is an associate scientist in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you to you both for your time this afternoon, and thanks to everybody for listening. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Have a great day.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR.